Chapter 18. Crimes of Passion. Crime passionnel, the crime of passion. The words conjure up dark-skinned Latins like Rudolph Valentino, and sultry girls with daggers concealed in their stockings. The passion killer is characterised by emotional immaturity and a simplistic moral outlook, said Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, an expert on sex crime. Perhaps this explains why criminologists have paid so little attention to the crime passionnel. It seems too simple, too straightforward. A hot-tempered man strangles his flirtatious mistress, or a jealous woman stabs her unfaithful lover. What is there to exercise the ingenuity of a psychologist? A great deal more than appears on the surface. It is true that southerners are more prone to commit crimes of passion than northerners. We say this because northerners are more cerebral and calculating, while southerners are more hot-blooded and emotional. But in that case, why is the rate of sex crime higher in northern countries? A man who commits murder for the satisfaction of a momentary physical impulse cannot really be said to be calmer or more calculating than a man who plans the murder of his mistress's husband. The real explanation is more complicated and altogether more interesting. In the northern countries, with their cold and difficult conditions, men and women have tended to develop as equals. They work hard together, and the women, muffled in their winter clothes, don't draw much attention to their physical attractions. Perhaps this explains why the Eskimos, according to early travellers, often used to offer their wives to guests. In warmer countries, the difference between male and female is more obvious. The sun-bronzed peasant of Italy or Spain wears her brightly coloured skirt and her off-the-shoulder blouse. Sexual maturity comes earlier in the warmer climate. And the consequence is that southern men and women see one another as two separate races, almost as separate species. When this happens, their view of one another becomes strangely intermingled with illusions and idealisations. The Russian writer Maxim Gorky has caught this with great psychological accuracy in his story 26 Men and a Girl. The men are baker's assistants, confined all day in a damp cellar, and they're all in love with a girl called Tanya, who calls there every day. One day, a swaggering soldier tells them that he could seduce Tanya, and he does it. Suddenly, the 26 men hate her. They turn on her and they scream insults at her, and Tanya haughtily walks off, never to return. She is the realist. The soldier may have treated her like a whore, but he's also given her pleasure. These men treat her like an angel, and then abuse her when she fails to live up to her image. This tradition of regarding woman as a romantic goddess has its roots deep in the southern cultural tradition. The troubadours were poets who flourished in southern France and northern Italy as early as the 11th century, and they invented the tradition of courtly love. The troubadour's lady was his absolute ruler. At a word from her, he would ride off around the world. The stories of King Arthur and his knights of the Round Table were first written in French by poets who were inspired by the troubadours and their attitude to women. Scholars believe that the whole tradition of troubadour love originated among the Arabs of North Africa. There is another and less pleasant side to the romantic view of woman. She is supposed to be quiet, obedient and infinitely yielding. The 14th century Italian poet Petrarch tells a story that remained popular for centuries. A nobleman who distrusts women finally marries a poor peasant girl called Griseldis. Then he proceeds to test her to see how obedient she is. First, he takes her children from her as soon as they're born. Then he announces that he intends to divorce her to marry another woman. Patient Griseldis agrees to everything, even attending his wedding and praising the beauty of the bride-to-be. Finally, overcome by her gentleness and her patience, the nobleman admits that he has merely been testing her. He takes her back, and they live happily ever after. Even if it is only a story, it captures the medieval attitude to women in a country like Spain or Italy. To modern ears, it sounds sadistic and slightly insane. Surely the nobleman could tell that she was a sweet, obedient girl without subjecting her to such humiliations. But that would not have satisfied Petrarch's readers, male or female, for Griseldis was supposed to be their idea of a perfect woman, beautiful, obedient, long-suffering, entirely dependent on man, her master. It is because these deep-rooted attitudes still persist in the southern temperament that southerners are prone to commit crimes of passion. The women who swooned over Rudolph Valentino or John Bowles had no idea what it would really be like to be married to a sheik. The rape in the desert might be exciting, but the rest could be hell, as Marguerite Laurent discovered when she married Prince Ali Kamal Bey Fahmy. But at least it was Prince Fahmy who ended with the three bullets in him. In so many parallel cases, it's the woman who dies. In 1972, Francisco Pineda, a car mechanic of Guadalajara, Mexico, walked into the bedroom of his employer, Fernando Ortega, a 32-year-old hunchback. His employer lay stretched on the floor in his pyjamas, dead. Francisco's pretty stepdaughter, Maria Pineda, lay dead on the bed as well, her skirt around her thighs. Police discovered that both had died of cyanide poisoning. Ortega had forced her to drink cyanide at knife point and then drank it himself. Ortega was suffering from tuberculosis. Maria had been acting as his nurse, administering injections. Ortega fell violently in love with her, but she was not attracted to the hunchback. She may have thought that the drink he forced on her contained knockout drops and that his intention was simply to rape her. In fact, in spite of the position of her dress, Maria had not been sexually molested. Ortega could have raped her before he killed himself, but that was not what he wanted. He loved her, and he wanted to join her in death. The tragedy was stupid, pathetic, and typical of Southern temperament. And we can clearly see the Southern attitude to women. Ortega adored her. She was his goddess. But she also had to pay with her life for the sin of disobedience to the male. To the Northern, pragmatic way of thinking, there is something absurd about such crimes of passion. What the Anglo-Saxon fails to understand about the Southern temperament is the way in which it can blind itself with emotion. How is it possible to deceive yourself without actually being insane? The French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre devoted some time to this problem, and in a work called A Sketch of a Theory of the Emotions, produced some important ideas. He makes the strange and revolutionary suggestion that all emotions should be regarded as a kind of wishful thinking, or, as he prefers to call it, magic. He's not using the word in its occult sense. When an ostrich buries its head in the sand at the approach of an enemy, it is hoping to make the enemy disappear by magic. If a girl faints as she's about to be attacked, says Sartre, this is not just a physical reaction. On the subconscious level, it's also an attempt to make the rapist go away by magic. All emotion, says Sartre, is a substitute for action. Take the case of a man who falls in love with a girl. If she also finds him attractive, they fall into one another's arms and he releases his desire for her in lovemaking. If she rejects him, as Maria Pineda rejected Ortega, the desire goes on building up, encouraged by his brooding, until he is wildly, passionately in love with her, entirely possessed by an emotion which is a substitute for lovemaking. In the same way, a man who gets angry and represses it builds up tremendous inner rage, out of all proportion to its object. The man who lets out his rage by shouting or fighting ceases to feel anger. All this may be dismissed as a clever but superficial theory, and indeed there are few psychologists who would accept it entirely. But where crime is concerned, it is of immense importance. It suddenly reveals the answer to problems that otherwise baffled normal people. For example, how could Ian Brady, the Moors murderer, kill innocent children? How could Manson and his followers slaughter people who'd done them no harm? According to Sartre, all emotion is out of proportion to its object. Why do children never enjoy Christmas as much as they expect to? Because they build up an emotion of expectation which is untrue, wishful thinking, or magic. The ideal way for a child to enjoy Christmas is not to know that it's coming until it's actually arrived, so it could simply act out its pleasure. Consider a murderer like the Dusseldorf sadist Peter Kürten. In long periods of solitary confinement, he built up such a loathing of society that no action could ever discharge it. He might murder men, women and children, set barns on fire, but, like the child at Christmas, he had built up an expectation that could never be satisfied. The same is true of killers like Manson and Brady. But it's when this theory is applied to the passion killers that we begin to recognise its frightening accuracy. Sometimes the whole crime is wrapped up in such a miasma of emotion that it seems unreal, like a crime committed in a nightmare. France's classic crime passionnel of the early 1950s revealed more than just an element of fantasy. It also contained a subconscious wish for self-destruction. When a middle-aged mother and French woman named Yvonne Chevalier landed by plane at the penal settlements in New Guinea, she had arrived to pay penance for the murder of her husband Pierre, winner of the Légion d'Honneur, on the day that he was made a minister of a newly formed French government of 1951. Pierre was a promising young doctor when he first met Yvonne, then a midwife in Orléans Hospital in 1935. They were a contrasting couple, he from an old and distinguished local family, she of peasant stock. Their love and passion for each other overcame their social differences, and they married 4 years later, when Pierre had joined the army in the fight against Hitler. The first of their two sons was born in 1940, and the second in 1945. Both boys were with Yvonne when she came to punish herself in the penal camps. Still not accepted by the Chevalier family, they regarded me as one of the mistakes of Pierre's youth, she later told her trial judge bitterly. She came to worship her gallant husband even more when he returned to Orléans and became one of the heroes of the local resistance movement. At the end of the hostilities, he was easily the most popular man in the community, and it was but a short step for him to enter the battleground of politics. He no longer concentrated on his career as a doctor, and Yvonne found herself even more out of place as the wife of an ambitious politician. Awkward, gauche, and conversationally clumsy, she didn't fit into the social life that Pierre was obliged to lead in Paris, the headquarters of French politics. As he spent more and more time in the capital, and she was left alone, but for her children, in her Orléans home, Yvonne was deprived of both emotional and physical love. She resorted to drugs, Veronal and Maxiton, to get her through the long days and the even longer nights. Then came the day she dreaded and knew to be inevitable, when she found a love letter in the pocket of one of Pierre's suits. It was from a woman named Jeanette, and it appeared that she was not, surprisingly enough, a Parisian social beauty. She came from the Orléans area, and Yvonne suspected that she was Jean Perrault, the beautiful, intelligent and ultra-presentable wife of the owner of one of the city's main department stores. Also, she was 15 years younger than Yvonne, who felt more than ever like the plain little countrywoman whose place in her husband's affections and bed had been taken by the sort of woman that he should have married. After staging a typically jealous and acrimonious scene with the red-headed Madame Perrault, and gaining no satisfaction in any direction, Yvonne turned her hatred full upon her husband. After arguing with him, fighting with him, pleading with him, but not loving with him, she took the children away from Orléans on a long seaside holiday. Without sparing words or feelings, Pierre had told her that he no longer wished to sleep with her and that he wanted a divorce. He believed his flourishing career would stand the publicity of a divorce action, and he had not bargained for the effect it would have on Yvonne. She tried to commit suicide. Then, when that failed, she went to the nearest police station and took out a license for a gun. She was immediately given a gun certificate on the grounds that, as the wife of a rising political figure, Pierre was now the mayor of Orléans, she might need to protect herself from his rivals or enemies. She next obtained a 7.65mm MAB automatic, took it home, and hid it in the upstairs linen closet. A short while later, she had yet another row with Pierre, when he again threatened to divorce her, and this time added that he had another woman in mind whom he would marry. This, for Yvonne, was the final insult, the last threat. She hurried out of the bedroom, took out the gun, returned, and pointed it not at Pierre, but at herself. "If you leave me for another woman, any woman, I'll kill myself!" she screamed. Pierre, who was undressing and was down to his underwear, was still jubilant about his appointment that day to the French government. His name was in all the papers, and his new job as a minister was the talking point of Orléans. But all this meant nothing to Yvonne. When he mocked her and he told her to go ahead and shoot herself, as soon as I'm out of the room, she turned the automatic upon him. 4 times she shot, rapidly and with deadly aim. With a cry of pain and terror, Pierre fell to the floor with bullets in the chest, the forearm, the thigh, and the chin. And a 5th bullet, fired minutes later, entered his back. As soon as she'd recovered her wits and realised what it was she had done, the gun went off by accident, she claimed later. She picked up the telephone and rang the Orléans police station. She spoke to a friend of hers and Pierre's, Commissaire Gazzano, and said simply, "Please come here at once. My husband needs you urgently." Within 2 hours, dressed in widow's weeds, she was placed in Orléans jail, and her trial for her crime of passion murder was held in November of 1952. It was then stated by the presiding judge, Monsieur Raymond Jardin, that she had an animal passion for her husband. You should have conquered it and had realized that you had no right to take the life of another person. This passion overwhelmed your whole way of life without you attempting to control it. I understand your Calvary, but do not condone it. A doctor who gave evidence stated that Yvonne had retained the mentality of a teenager in love with a student, stressing her feelings of inferiority, socially, physically, and intellectually. He concluded that she suffered from physical depreciation because her husband refused to make love to her. She despaired of ever being the equal of the man whom she'd never stopped loving. That was her state of mind at the time she killed him. It took Madame Jean Perrault, 34, and, she said, of no profession, to admit to the court that she became Pierre Chevalier's mistress in 1950 for the jury to feel sympathy for Yvonne. Her lawyer asked with emotion whether her two sons were to grow up alone in the world, and the jurors answered with an unequivocal no. They found Madame Chevalier not guilty, and on her acquittal there were few people in the packed courtroom, gendarme included, who did not show their relief. Her self-punishment in New Guinea, a sentence she awarded herself after receiving absolution from the church for her crime, was a telling example of the guilt felt by those who commit crimes of passion. Most such murders are committed not out of genuine hatred, but out of spurned love. If affection is freely given and generously returned, crimes of passion would be removed from the criminal calendar. It's up to the man or woman in a relationship to ensure that if a break has to come, then it is made gently, with tact and kindness. In that way, they will be protecting and lengthening their own lives.